church employs electionary, which means it's just a reading plan. That's a fancy word for it. And we can always see it online on our website, because you can go from there. But we're getting through the Bible, and we're only spending 1 week in the Proverbs during this Palm Sunday. And the Proverbs is just quite long. It's got about 30 chapters to it. I'd like to sort of capsulize some of this, because we visit it every year. We read through the Bible every single year, using a lecture. And in 3 years, you would have read every single verse in the Bible. But we do pause at every one. We spend more time in Proverbs than other years. But this year, we only have 1 year spent in it. And I want to just give you an idea and revisit what the Proverbs are about. Now, first of all, the Proverbs are a collection of general wisdom. And it was designed as an instruction book for the princes of the kingdom of Israel. They'd be educated, and they have these wise people come in and teach them. The people who knew how to run a kingdom, stuff like this, advisors to the king, they would come and they would teach. And this became a kind of a text that was collected for them. What you need to know is that the book of Proverbs blends both godly wisdom with worldly wisdom. So you'll find some of these Proverbs are actually collected from other cultures as well in that area. Other wisdom books or teaching like this were collected during the ancient times. In the book of Proverbs, there are actually 7 smaller collections. And actually you can read some. For example, if you have your Bibles with you, in some of your versions, it may say the Proverbs of Solomon. That's the first of 7 other collections. Now, one thing you have to know about collecting sayings, proverbs, or idioms is that not all sayings are universally true. You have to understand that. Not all sayings are universally true. Just because it's a nice, saying that we brought in tradition or whatever else, doesn't mean it's necessarily true. And in the Proverbs, some are in tension with one another. They're true to a certain degree, but they need to be balanced out. For example, this truth, or proverb, that a rich man has many friends. What do we mean by friends? Right? Now, so there's a lot of complexity, and so there's these balances and tensions that are within the proverbs themselves. Certain proverbs will be in tension with each other, maybe not directly, but indirectly. And in other cases, it says the blows of friends are to be trusted, while an enemy multiplies kisses. So if you put those two proverbs that I just mentioned together, that a rich person has many friends, you don't know that these are not necessarily really friends. If you bring that other proverb in, you begin to wonder, is that person really a friend or an enemy? So there's all these interesting blends of things. And it doesn't, because they're just little snippets, these idioms and sayings, we have to take with a grain of salt. Each saying does contain some kernel of truth, but not the truth entire. And so, they must be seen as a web of understanding and relate to each other and create a more dynamic tension and a web of wisdom together. But having said that, you can't write your life on just idioms. Right. You have to have something more stable. And how do we know then which of these sayings, which of these proverbs are actually true wisdom? How do we tell if this book is just a collection of wisdom or of sayings? How do we judge between one proverb or another? Well, thankfully, whoever collected the proverbs together puts the key in the first 9 chapters. Very important. The most important sections of the book of Proverbs are not the 7 collections, but the first 9 chapters. Chapters 1 through 7 are kind of a core teaching. And it is it's kind of a prologue and epilogue at the same time in chapters 8 and 9. And what we're going to be looking at today, and as Anne has read for us, is the closing section. Now, there's one thing I need to say about what the key actually is throughout the first 9 chapters. It's stated again and again, but it is simply this. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. It is repeated again and again and again to make sure that the person who's being instructed in living wisely will not miss this foundational understanding of what wisdom actually is. Now, the words, the fear of the Lord may bear a little bit of a description. We had a conversation about this several weeks ago. And I have to say, when looking into it, the English translation does need a little bit of unpacking. First of all, the fear of the Lord is not just a series of words. It's actually a singular concept. Like love and peace, for example, might be joined together. You know, so it's actually it's what we call a compound, sort of phrase that embodies a singular thought. And so, for example, when we say the fear of the Lord, in the ancient texts, when we have the words the fear of God in general, we have, it means that you respect the laws, the general morality of what's handed down by the gods, so to speak. But when you talk about the fear of the Lord, and it's an interesting thing because in many modern translations, the word Lord, and in the NIV and the TNIV, as they use the international version and the international version, they have a capital L-O-R-D. If you're wondering why do they capitalize that whole thing, it's actually the covenant name of God in the Old Testament. And the name of God is actually spelled in English, and we're translating it, and it's Y-H-W-H. We don't have any vowel points on it, but Yahweh is one of the ways that we translate it. Or Jehovah in more older texts. But what you have is that you're looking at the fear of Yahweh, or Adonai, if we're Hebrews. We wouldn't actually use the name of God in that perspective. And actually, the words, the fear of Yahweh, the fear of Adonai, has both a rational and psychological component, or emotional, affective component. The understanding, just like the fear of God or the gods, is that instead of just a general morality or list of rules that they respect, the fear of God in a rational sense is saying, I stand under the revelation of God. He has authority over me. God's saying has authority over me. So, when we think of fear in English, it's kind of problematic. It's like, I'm insecure. That's not what it refers to at all. It means that there's a respect for it. But there is this emotional affective understanding that has the fear of the Lord. Psychologically, there's an intertwining of love and awe. Bruce Waltke, a commentator, a Bible scholar, and you hear this a fair bit, he quotes C.S. Lewis in the description of Aslan to the children who go to Narnia. They ask him, if Aslan, the lion, is safe. And the creature of Narnia said, "Safe? Goodness, no. He's not safe, but he's good." And so when we have the fear of the Lord, there's this understanding of both of an affection and a love for God, as well as a deep respect and awe of God. He is a dangerous, powerful God. Not frivolous, but good. So, that's something that helped us along the way. This is the foundational understanding. In fact, the same Bible scholar Bruce Waltke mentions that the closest English word we may actually have to contain this compound word or phrase in English is the word humility. Humility is our closest English equivalent of this understanding to the words the fear of the Lord, the fear of Adonai. So therefore, another way that it can be understood God is the King of wisdom. All the problems are measured by our relationship with God, how we see Him, and how we humble ourselves before Him. And chapter 9, which we're going to be visiting, is the very last portion of this true instruction before they basically let you loose on all the collection of words and phrases and idioms and proverbs. It is both epilogue and final word. And so this is why I decided that this would be the portion that we're studying this morning. So let us visit the text itself. This text, chapter 9, is really about two rivals. It tells a story like a lot of wisdom literature will do. It sets up a sort of an image. And the two rivals are found both at the beginning and then at the end of this chapter. There are two women holding two different banquets, so to speak, or have given two invitations. Both prepare their feast, and then give an invitation, and there's an evaluation of what it is that will happen if you accept the invitations. The first is Lady Wisdom, who is described as being noble and trustworthy. But then there is the other, who is Mistress Folly, so this is the foolishness, who is pretentious. Verses 1 through 6 of chapter 9 describe Lady Wisdom and her invitation, whereas verses 13 to 18 describe Mistress Folly and her invitation. And they are in contrast to one another. If you read it, they there's an intentional playing off of one another. Wisdom, it says, has built her house, has set up seven pillars, seven being a perfect and divine number, meaning that her house is solid. But she goes on to say she's prepared her meat and mixed her wine. Sounds like a good meal. On the other hand, in verse 13, it simply says Folly is an unruly woman. She is simple and knows nothing. That's the contrast. So you have one person who is actually preparing a meal, and it describes it being with meat and mixed wine, which is an art in itself in that day and age. Whereas, as foolishness, they're not really prepared at all. It simply says that they're disorganized, unruly. Doesn't really care. It doesn't matter to them. And so this is how these two women are preparing in this image. It goes on to say how they then give the invitation. Lady Wisdom actually has servants, has those who work with her and for her. But not only does she send out her servant, it says that she herself goes out. And she goes to the high place to give the invitation. Lady Folly, it says, sits in her door. Doesn't go out, doesn't send out her servant, simply sits there. But she too is heard at the high place for some reason. It's a mixing of images. How did she get to the high place? Is her house built there? Well, it's an image that both of them are being heard and seen. And it's very curious. One other thing that is noted about Mistress Folly in this description is that in verse 15, it says she's calling out to those who pass by from her doorway, which means that she's kind of lazy, basically. But she said, it says this. She calls those pass by who go straight on their way. In other words, those who have a course in life, she is attempting to derail. That is what she does. So these are things to note throughout the text. But what they say is very similar. In fact, the same. Let all who are sinful come to my house. That's what they both say. And in this further description, wisdom says, come eat my food and drink the wine I've mixed. Leave your sinful ways and you will live. Whereas folly says, stolen water is sweet. And food eaten in secret is delicious. So wisdom is earnest and straightforward, offering what she works for, to offer and give of her work. Whereas folly speaks of what is stored in secret, what is illicit and deliciously sensual. Ultimately, we know that one offers life, while the other one tricks others to death. Should be pretty obvious. I mean, which one wishes to choose, right? I think the Proverbs make it pretty clear. So what is this about? Why even put this stuff out here? Isn't it kind of obvious? Like, well, you see a thing that's going to get this news fast. You know, professor. Well, I think it's very obvious. You don't want to go with the bad lady. You want to go with the good lady. Right? And I can see a professor laughing. Yeah, that's kind of obvious. And I have to say, that's pretty obvious too. No one here, I think, in their right mind is going to say, oh yeah, I'm going to go with Lady Folly, you know, to the death. That doesn't make any sense. And earlier, you have to understand, in chapters 1 through 7, there's a temptress involved with the image of being Lady Folly, who is the adulteress, who leaves her husband to tempt other men. So there's a sexual innuendo to that as well. But is this really as obvious? Because obviously, in the city of Vancouver, there isn't someone with like some, you know, truck driving through the streets coming and saying, you know, all you who are simple, you know, come and join me at my party. It's a lot more subtle than that. In your life, in mine, and in our culture and society. So what is the real teaching then? How is this applicable to us? Well, we're not necessarily too far from the text yet. Because really it describes three people throughout the first nine chapters. And one of the people is already spoken of in the two passages we compare, the two rivals. The person that they call out to. The one who is simple. Another translation is understood as the one who is gullible. The one who is apostate, the one who has left the teaching of their family. Have gone their own way, described as an inexperienced and undecided young person. A person who's undeveloped, or someone who prefers to sit on the fence in life, in regards to their ethics and their morality. It is this person that folly and wisdom fight over, because they are a cuss. They are an undecided person. Kind of like if you're looking at the politics, the undecided voters. I might talk about that person, I don't know who that is. But, you know, there it is. But this is not a voter, this is a person who has a way of life. Their way of life is undecided. They have no anchor. And so, folly and wisdom speak to that person. There are two other people, though, in the Proverbs, and they are spoken of in the rest of this proverb. In a section that's in between. And you notice we kind of jumped from verses 6 all the way to 13 all of a sudden. But then we've got all these verses, these six verses in between too. So six verses about wisdom, and this six verse interlude. And then there's six verses about folly. What happens in this middle section? It's just sort of thrown in there. Not worded. Remember, this is the final word. You know, before you let the young princes into the wide world of problems, what does the teacher want you to know? This portion describes two other people. I'm just going to read it to you from today's New International Version. Whoever corrects a mocker or scoffer in the NASB invites insult. Do not rebuke mockers, or they will hate you. Rebuke the wise, and they will love you. Instruct the wise, and they'll be wiser still. Teach the righteous, and they will add to their wisdom. sinful person that wisdom and folly are calling to is to other people. And that is the wise and the wicked. Or, another word is the scoffer or the mocker. The difference between the sinful person and these two is the simple person is wishy-washy. Whereas the wise person has chosen a course in life. As much as the mocker has chosen a course in life. The Proverbs simply say that those who have chosen the path of wisdom will become wiser still. There's the way of life. And you can help that person. That person will grow. That person will develop. The mocker will not. Inasmuch as you add wisdom to them, they will not listen. They have set their course in life. And so, this is an exposition about these two other people. This is why the Proverbs is not really for these two, although it describes them. In fact, I would say, if you're trying to instruct princes, it is a way of saying, look, you must choose one of two ways. You might be in the middle now. Wisdom and folly will call to you, but in life you will go one direction or another. And this is what we're talking about. The wise crave evaluation, reflection, instruction, correction. They don't mind criticism. They will hear it, and they will become wiser still. But those who are foolish, those who are mockers, hate these things. They don't want to be evaluated. They don't want to reflect on their lives. They don't want to be instructed. They don't want to be corrected. And they become callous. Even the pagan philosopher Socrates knows this truth. This is a general proverb. He's the one who's often quoted as a saying, all I know. And he's a wise guy. All I know is that I know nothing. Often quoted in many different ways, the wise man knows that they know nothing. But Socrates himself says this of himself. And like a proverb, of course, it's a bit of an overstatement, right? All I know is I know nothing. What do you know? But it's an idiot. It's a sin. And it's a wise one to that. But how does this now apply to us? Because we want to say, it's still obvious, isn't it? None of us want to be, the mocker, the foolish person. And we all want to be the wise person, right? This is a no-brainer again. Professor, I'm falling asleep. But here's where it goes. This is where the real application may be. This passage of Proverbs is interesting because it's called poetry, it includes imagery. But understand this for us. I believe that what it is that we don't put ourselves in categories of being, wise, simple, or foolish mockers. It's about our inclination. Catch that? It is about our inclinations. In other words, there is in us the possibility of all three of these characteristics and characters to be in us. Sometimes we are simple. This is the part of us that still needs formation. The things that we are undecided in. The things that we do not hold to, where we sit on the fence or are tempted in our lives. These are the things that remain unsettled. And sometimes we are like this when we are unable to do what we know is right. The Apostle Paul writes about this. I know the good I should do, but I don't do it. And the good I know I should do, I don't do that. This is the nature of being lost. We face temptation and wisdom will call to us, as will foolishness and folly. There are two natures at war within us. And some of you know what that feels like. And in this case, we have that inclination of the simple, the person who is simple, who is in need of wisdom, to find our path. But sometimes we have a second characteristic as well, and that is the nature of pride. Think of when you found it hard, or you found yourself unable to take correction, rebuke, or even criticism. Whenever you look suspiciously upon one who makes you uncomfortable because they are not stroking your ego, think of when you might want to lash out and blame others rather than look at yourself. Think about your desire to make yourself look better in the eyes of other people. You become a mocker. And hope for us in regards to wisdom slips away. We then take folly again because it makes us feel better about ourselves or makes us feel good. But our pride, our mockery will destroy us. This is what the Proverbs is pointing to. The other and last nature of this nature is actually the wise person. The one who has the fear of the Lord in him. And remember what I equated that to. And there's a fellow that I met a while back who was a professor, and John Kimball, who ran into some of the church conferences in the past, our church and other church conferences. And he gave this wonderful description of a humble person, and I want to submit it to you for your consideration. This is the third nature. This is the one that Jesus embodied. So, I printed it. I'll put it out on the screen, so I'm going to let you look. You know, walk through it. Humble people. Yeah, that's what it says. And these are following descriptions of what we might want to consider. Humble people are not concerned to make an impression on the world. I'm not saying they don't make a difference, but an impression. Impressing the people around them. Humble people set aside the flowering of their own personality. They don't need to boost themselves. Humble people do not take themselves too seriously. They can laugh at themselves. Oh, I'm such an idiot. That's all right. It's okay. Which means they also have a sense of humor about themselves. They can laugh at themselves. Living perfection. They are not set off track by personal degradation. What I mean by that is, well, the contrast of it is this. They're not set off track by personal eminence. By success or failure, it does not, or what people say about them, what is graded, you know, in that sense, or lifted up, it doesn't affect them. It doesn't change their track in life. Humble people are not impatient when people praise or affirm them. That's important. So there's no false humility going on. Humble people are not haunted or obsessed by things that are said about them. Yes, gossip happens. It just happens. But they don't become obsessed with that. Humble people waste no time defending their own reputation. That's the point. people are not afraid of failure. Humble people are not downcast after committing a fault. They don't beat themselves. They're obsessed about that. Humble people can exist without getting any special recognition. They're comfortable with who they are. Humble people are able to weigh criticism. Humble people don't believe that it all depends on them. Humble people think of God. Humble people direct their hearts and mind to God and the things of God. And there's one more that disappears in them. And that is, humble people are confident in the power of God. The last year is quite interesting because it all makes sense. Because they all mean that this person focuses their value on how God sees them. Not only on how God sees them, but their reliance upon God. We don't need to be perfect. Now, this is a blend, since we're in the Proverbs, of kind of Proverbs of things. We'll probably be lower that later on. But yeah, so these are some of the things that came up. Oh, if you want to send us to the whole church, so that like you like to keep and those. There's a lot of things here, and I want you to concentrate on thinking it through. Oh, he's going to turn this off next. We're going to go to the next slide. That's okay. I will send this out because I find it very helpful. This is the measure of a wise person. It's a composite again, and it tells intention. So it's not like just one line is going to do it all. And there's more. So it's a complex understanding. But this is what we want to strive towards. A life of humility. So what does this mean? If you are in a place of being undecided in your life, of the path that you choose, you are invited and know that you can be vulnerable to both what is good in terms of wisdom, but also what is wicked in terms of folly. Our entire culture tempts us one way or the other. And this, of course, can be a daily or a long-term issue. Our whole families, you know, exude a lot of these issues upon us as well, where we grew up. But you must still decide. You will hear the call of both wisdom and following upon you. Not just today, but for the rest of your life. These voices will come. You choose either being wanting to be wise or foolish, humble or proud. And I have to tell you, this is not an immediate thing. You can't just say, okay, the pastor said this is a good idea, I'm going to choose wisdom, I'm going to be humble. I wish it was that way. You know, and I'll send the door to you all a humble pill. You know, and then you'll go, oh, getting more humble, I feel it already. Something like that. Humility or folly happens in increments. The spiritual life is not a sprint, as they say, but a marathon. It's about putting one foot in front of the other sometimes. It's a pilgrimage. You see, Jesus is the one that epitomizes wisdom. Because even on Palm Sunday, what we remember is this. At a certain point, he turns to the disciples and he says, I am going to Jerusalem to die. That's what he says. Of course, they try to talk him out of it, and they're going, oh, you know, what's going on? One foot in front of the other, Jesus moves the cross. The fanfare of Palm Sunday is in stark contrast to what will happen throughout Holy Week. And those who wave their palms and wave their jackets down became disillusioned with them quickly enough. And there were factions that existed and wished to destroy them. that Jesus never entered, whether by the accolades of thousands or the streets of Paul Sunday. So the vilification of those who tried to talk about it, they gave him a chance. Are you the king of the Jews? Will you blaspheme so that he can accuse you? But Jesus told him to who he was. And this week we're going to visit all those things on Good Friday when we get to that place of his life. Has made the message. The garden of Gethsemane. What he must believe these three last things. What face is now? May you who follow Jesus follow him closely. He who is the epitome of humility and love. And may you resist the devil who would like to stroke your ego and sell you a lie. That's right. Lord Jesus, in this day of Palm Sunday, we celebrate. But we are simple, certain ways. We need your wisdom. We can only say and pray, you want to be wise. You want to be humble. Help us to be audacious enough and courageous enough to ask you for those things. Make us courageous. Make us wise. Make us humble. Know it's full well. That is not enough. So Lord, help us and instruct us. Help us to follow you. Give us your spirit.